Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, October 29th. I'm Ray Graff. Gardening today, we welcome two of our favorites, horticulturalist Bob Graves of Fadigan's Nursery and arborist Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum. They're on the line today to answer your questions about gardening and plant preparation this fall. Give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. And I tell you honestly, it will likely be a busy show. The emails began coming in about noon today. So call early if you want to get in, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Bob and Fred and your gardening calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's gardening today, and joining us, Bob Graves from Fadigan's Nursery and Fred Breglia of the Landis Arboretum. We welcome your gardening questions, and it's funny, we could do this show, and we have done this show in the dead of winter, and the lines light up. Everybody likes to talk about gardening. Give us a call if you have a question or a comment, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number is 800-348-2551. Bob Graves, how you doing?
Hey, I'm here. Good to be back.
Are you okay? I know you're here, but you feeling
all
right?
I'm good. Good, I'm man. Very good. I'm real happy to see some genuine rain for a change.
Yeah, it's raining out there now. How are things at Fadigan's?
We're busy. We're kind of winding up the outdoor season and getting ready for the holiday season.
It's almost that time. Fred Breglia,
almost.
How are things at the Landis Arboretum, sir?
We're doing great. Thanks for having us, Ray. Looking forward to the show. Some big recent news that the Landis Arboretum was inducted into the National Old Growth Forest Network, which is a organization that is helping to preserve old growth forests. And we've always been talking about big trees and old growth and the importance to preserve them. And it's just another nice feather in the Landis hat to say that we are now, you know, working with the Old Growth Forest Network to maintain the forest for the longevity, for the future, for the kids. So just been doing really good and starting to get things ready for the impending cold that's, you know, ultimately coming our way.
Well, congratulations on that. Now, what does the network actually do?
Well, the Old Growth Forest Network is looking to establish an old growth forest, if it can be achieved, in virtually almost every county across the United States. And therefore, you know, kids can go to the old growth forest of the future, and, you know, people that have been able to see old growth, you know, they're fortunate, but a lot of people have not. So it's really trying to bring out the importance of preserving old growth and also to actually take it a step further and actually find or document a forest in almost every county. Now, there's still a lot of counties that haven't been done, but the Arboretum Old Growth Forests are officially part of the network. So been just really great to have that sort of come all together.
Now, to qualify as old growth, how old do we have to be?
Well, you know, the trees really vary a lot. So some trees, you know, don't have to be quite as old to be considered old growth. But our typical northeastern old growth forest around here, you know, we like to see trees definitely exceeding 150 average on the older side of 150 years on the average old tree in the forest. And many of the trees at the Arboretum exceed 200, some of them even 250. Our old great oak that unfortunately passed away back at the hands of Hurricane Irene, that one was estimated to be over 400 years old. So we've got some really substantially old trees here. We found, you know, trees in our area that are over 450 years old as well. So
Wow. There's
a lot of old trees out there, but if we're talking, you know, West Coast standards, then redwoods, of course, would be considered old growth when they start to get closer to 1,000 years old. So, you know, it really does vary a lot with the species. But northeastern, we're looking at that 150, 200-year range.
Now, we have a lot of callers already, and I certainly don't want Bob Graves to nod off or get irritated, but I want to ask one more question here. You know, you mentioned this old oak that sadly passed away, and I know how they can check the age of these trees, you know, with a sample, and you look at the rings and whatnot. But how do you gauge the age of a tree that's still alive and thriving?
It's a good question. You know, a lot of times you can use increment borings, which is basically a small hole that goes in and sort of takes a sample plug out of the tree. And in that little sample plug, you can actually see the lines. And very much just like if you took a cross-section of a tree and counted the rings, you would be able to do that on a little plug of that's basically extracted from a tree. Now, a lot of times on these really old trees, they're hollow inside, so it's hard to get an actual ring count from those trees. So yeah, we have to use other methods to sort of extrapolate the ages. But I will say that on the great oak tree before its demise, it was a hollow tree, so we have not documented that main trunk section to 400, but most experts have said that, you know, exceeded 400. There has been a branch that came off one time, one of the larger branches, with 283 rings on it, I believe. So
wow,
that's just a branch off of one of the major branches off of the great oak. So we know it's over 283.
So cool. So cool.
Yeah, really cool. It's you know, you can learn a lot from trees, and you know, you can even see the weather patterns that have occurred over hundreds and hundreds of years around here. And when you look at that data, you can see the droughts, you can see when there was feast, you can see when there was famine.
Very
pretty cool.
All right, Fred Breglia, director of the Landis Arboretum, is here. Bob Graves from Fadigan's Nursery is here. And Bob, since you haven't had anything to say for the last several minutes, you can have the first email. We'll take a few emails, we'll take a break, and then we'll hit the phones. This one is from Sharon in Claverick. Sharon says, I grew butternut squash for the first time this summer. I still have two large squashes on the vine. The vine has been 95% killed by frost, but the squashes are only half ripe. If I pick them today, because the snow is in the forecast tomorrow, will they continue to ripen off the vine?
Typically, yes, but at the same, you don't have a whole lot of options. I mean, once they get frosted and the leaves and vines are gone, there's going to be no choice. They're not going to ripen there.
Yeah.
But some vegetables will continue to ripen, and sometimes there's certain procedures you can do to hasten that. But you know, for example, a lot of farmers right now are picking green tomatoes like crazy because they will ripen easily afterwards.
Well, it was a great year for tomatoes, at least at our house. We've had several years of no luck, and then we gave up for a year or two. This year, we got a ton of them, and there's still some green ones on there, I think.
Yeah, they like the heat. They like heat. Yeah.
All right, another email here. We'll throw this one Fred's way. I have a few hardy hibiscus plants that haven't grown well in too much shade. After 2 years, they only grew about 15 inches where they are. Still green today. When I transplant them, is it best to do it ASAP? In spring, before any visible growth, or in later spring, after visible growth has begun?
I guess I would say, you know, in the spring prior to the growth would be a good time to sort of transplant them. There's two kind of good times to transplant most plants, and, you know, usually when the plant is kind of going to sleep or slowing down, generally that's the best time to kind of move them. But springtime prior to growth would be a good time to transplant, for sure.
And on that particular plant, if it's the hardy hibiscus, they tend to come to life late in the spring, so it gives you a little more time to accomplish it next year.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep, and I would wait till, you know, your temperatures start to get up there in that, like, that, you know, that obviously that warmer kind of zone. When we start to get those spring temperatures, that's a great time to move. And like Bob said, they are kind of sometimes late to the show.
This one's from Dee in Altamont. Either one of you guys jump in here. Would you recommend a hydrangea vine for a trellis on the north side of the house? The site never gets sun. I tried Virginia creeper this year, but its growth was not vigorous. And that's from Dee in Altamont.
Yeah, that hydrangea vine is a wonderful plant in the shade. Now, the only thing to recognize with it is it gets a lot bigger and heavier than you might think. So whatever you're going to put it on, it's got to be pretty substantial. We had it on a metal arbor one time, and it just completely outgrew that in just a few years. But yes, it's an excellent plant for the shade.
Yeah, tree. Yep. Go ahead, Fred.
I was just going to say it's one of my favorite probably vines out there for the Northeast. It's an incredibly good vine. Can't say enough good stuff about climbing hydrangea.
All right, here's one for the arborist. This is from Chris in Cornwall. We have a 40 to 50 foot tall sugar maple that lost a huge branch from the middle of the tree in a storm last April. Now the tree is mostly limbless from base to crown. A friend told me that the tree is now top-heavy and its crown should be thinned. One, is this a good idea? Two, how and when should it be done?
Well, you know, good question. First off, you know, just because you've lost some material in terms of a large branch and a good chunk of the canopy, you really want to, especially if it's old, you want to have a really good reason for taking out live wood. So going in there and just thinning out a canopy on an older maple is not really recommended. But what would be recommended because of the failure of the major branch or maiden leader, sounds like, you know, an ISA consult by a certified arborist would be in line to kind of see if the tree might need some other work. It very well may not need to be thinned, but it might need a cable in there to help keep it together. There could be some hazardous branches that are potentially, you know, that could fail. So I think, you know, having at least a certified arborist come in there and consult with him on that tree would be best. And he can find a certified arborist in his area by going to a free resource website that the International Society has put out. It's called treesaregood.com, treesaregood.com. And you can go on there and you can search for a certified arborist in your area by zip code. There's a bunch of other consumer-based information there, like proper tree planting, proper pruning, proper mulching, and they're all free downloads as well, all PDF and available. And these are what I like to say, the facts proven about tree care through research, not opinion. So you could really use that site as sort of the gospel when it comes to tree care.
Okay.
Treesaregood.com.
Treesaregood.com. Doreen writes this one, and we'll send this one Bob's way, and then we'll take a quick break. Doreen writes, I have a whiskey barrel. Got my attention right away. I have a whiskey barrel full of beautiful, very alive zinnias. Still have not had the first frost, but it's supposed to snow tonight. Usually I cut them and make a bouquet, but this year I'd like to save the seeds. Should I leave the flowers outdoors, or can I cut them and let them dry indoors and then harvest them when they die in the vase? And that's from Doreen.
Yeah, you could do either, but recognize when you're working with seeds that you collect, they usually have to go through a process where they are subjected to normal temperatures. And you'd want to look that up for a particular plants, and you could go to propagation of zinnias, just Google that, and it'll tell you, you know, seeds sometimes will need a certain number of weeks at a certain temperature. So if you were to bring it inside and it didn't get those temperatures that they normally would get, they wouldn't germinate as well. So that's something you want to investigate. You can leave them outside for sure. I mean, there's just no problem doing that. And if you wanted to harvest, if they haven't gone to seed yet, and you want to harvest them and bring them in and try to keep them going, that makes sense. But then you may need at some point to provide them with certain temperatures.
All right, let's take a quick break. Bob Graves and Fred Breglia here to answer your gardening questions, and we will get to the phones right after this break. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Vox Pop. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Gardening today with Fred Breglia and Bob Graves. Let's start out with Mike in Richmond. Mike, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. The answer to the question about the hydrangea led me to think about my situation. I have a pergola that I currently have a kiwi vine growing on, and I was wondering, could I exchange that for a climbing hydrangea? Can they grow on pergolas that need a vertical surface? I want to get to my original question if I could.
All right.
Yeah, sure. Yep. Yeah, they'll grow in sun or shade. Because we talked to them about them before growing in the shade, they don't have to. They'll grow very well in the sun, and they'll do fine on a pergola. And again, they get pretty substantial. I've seen one. I think there's one on the Law Library at Cornell that's practically the whole side of a building. So just keep in mind they do get pretty good.
Gotcha.
Size.
Gotcha. Thank you. So I was putting my garden beds to sleep for the winter and noticed that the daylilies had fallen for the climate change hoax. They're putting out new growth and they haven't flowered, of course, but I was wondering, is that going to set them back next year if they continue to believe in the hoax?
You want to take that one, Fred?
Yeah, what kind of plant has come back? What did you say it was? Lilac?
A common daylily.
Common daylily.
Oh, the common daylily. No, I don't think you're going to have to worry about any kind of die-off on that. No, they're about as tough as they get. Some trees, if they do get tricked into late growth could and plants could get very much damaged. But with common daylily, nope, wouldn't worry at all. You're virtually guaranteed to get those back.
They're hard to kill anyway.
Mike,
they're tough plants. Yep, they are. They're a great plant for the right spot, though. But yeah, one of the things that makes them great is that they are tough and good looking. So,
Mike, thanks
kinda
for
like
the
me.
Call. All right, Fred Bregley and Bob Graves join us on the show today, and Nicholas is in Mechanicville. Nicholas,
hi. My wife is wondering how her house plants got scales. She's not sure how they got them or how they're getting in between them. They're spreading from plant to plant.
Yeah. Were they outside at all? Were the house plants outside for the summer? No, they're inside.
Yeah, them from Home Depot and stuff like that.
What you have to recognize with scale is there's a lot of different types of scale. And there's the mother scale that's either, it's a white or a brownish bump usually, almost looks like a little bitty wart on the plant. And if you were to take one of those scales and turn it over and look at it under a microscope, the crawling stage of that in one of these little bitty bumps that's, not much bigger than the head of a pin, you may have dozens of babies because they're small, they're like dust, and they're carried in the wind. The crawlers, they're called crawlers when they come out. And they can just be moved by the wind, by the passing of your person back and forth. They can spread. Now, scales generally have their preferences. There, some of them are species-specific. That is, they're scales that are going to get on one type of plant that won't get on another type of plant that won't get on another type of plant. So it's very easy for them to move. And, they can come in from outside. They can come in on your clothes. They can come in on the breeze. But usually the best treatment for that inside is either an insecticidal soap or an oil that you would spray on them, things that are not toxic, that are fairly safe, and that suffocates the insect. But it could take you many weeks or months to get it under control.
Wow, I didn't know they could travel in the wind.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely. They can be a pain. And when you do spray them, make sure you're spraying underneath the leaves. A lot of times people will miss the undersides, but a lot of those scale are on the underside. And unless you have a really, lot of plants, I would also recommend maybe just kind of meticulously going through, and if you see those little bumps, they kind of, you can scrape them off very gently without hitting plant tissue or even kind of, mechanically removing them with your finger or a little soft thing. You don't want to scratch the plant up, but that'll help as well when you spray the soaps. They are fairly easy to control on house plants, but it does take, like Bob had said, some persistence.
Yeah, Fred's right. With the insecticidal soaps or the oils, basically they're a contact killer. If you don't hit it, you don't kill it.
Nicholas, thanks for the call. It's Gardening Today on Vox Pop, and our number is 800-348-2551. Bob Graves from Fadigan's Nursery and Fred Breglia from Landis Arboretum here today. Let's go to Marla in Falls Village, Connecticut. Marla.
Thanks for taking my call, guys.
Hi.
How can I eradicate bittersweet that has taken over a hosta and daylily bed?
You got that one, Fred.
thanks, Bob.
Nice.
One of the easiest ways to get it, and like a lot of these things, being persistent pays off. And this is no exception to the rule. So what I would do is I would wait for the springtime now at this point in the game, because the plant is actually storing a lot of that energy that it's going to use for the regrowth next year in its roots. So cutting it now may not really get you too far ahead. But waiting for the spring and keeping a really good eye on that plant, and when you see that plant leaf out, you got to remember that it's doing it that very first time from stored energy only. And this is a great way to get rid of a lot of those hard-to-get-rid-of woody plants, not just bittersweet. You wait for it to use that energy up on the new set of leaves, and then a lot of that energy in that root system is gone, and then it's counting on that first set of leaves to start to photosynthesize and make more food and keep the plant alive. But if you come in and kind of cut that right at the ground, right after it used all its energy, it's weakened dramatically, and it will try to survive by putting up sort of a second or even maybe a third little flush of growth. And then as soon as you see that new growth, you cut it again, and you see any more, you cut it again, and you're going to make that plant use up its energy, and you're not going to help the root system come back, and it's going to end up eventually getting rid of those plants for you, as long as you can get to them and cut them. I've had great luck getting rid of a lot of hard-to-get-rid-of plants that way.
the thing you want to keep in mind with something like bittersweet is if you get rid of that, it's going to come back because it's there because the birds consumed the seed and they came over and pooped it out in that spot. Ah. And they're going to do it again, and they're going to do
That's
it again,
true.
And they're going to do it again. So you may be something you just do routinely every year.
Yep. Good point, because
well,
that's one of the ways.
We got the vines off the tree.
What'd you say, Marla?
So we got the vines off the tree.
Good.
But
okay.
Last year, and so all that fell down, and now I'll just hit it in the spring.
Yeah, just keep cutting it, and if it's in an area where you can bring like a weed whacker in on that new soft growth that's coming in, I mean, you could even, especially if there's new ones that are coming, like Bob had said, from the birds, if you can get a weed whacker in there, it just doesn't take mowing. None of these types of plants can handle any type of routine mowing or cutting. So you always win if as long as you keep up on it.
All right, Marla,
it's
thank
a bad
you.
Vine.
Thank you very much for the call. Bob, you want to follow up there briefly?
Nope, we got it covered on that one.
Okie doke. Our number is 800-348-2551. It's Gardening Today on Vox Pop, and let's go to Ryan in Malta. Ryan, you're on.
Hi. Another animal control problem.
All right.
Moles, and I guess up here we have more of woodchucks. How do I get rid of the moles? Because they've eaten a lot of the bulbs I've already planted for next year. And the woodchucks, I kill one off and two more come.
The thing you want to be aware here is that the moles may not be your problem or may not be your only problem. It may be voles with a V as in Victor. The voles will more likely eat your bulbs and your plants and roots of perennials and bark of trees and things like that. Moles, with an M as in Mike, primarily eat earthworms and grubs, and they'll eat they're omnivores. They'll eat plants too, but that's not their main food source. Now, to get rid of the voles, you can use traps, mouse traps. You bait it with some peanut butter, put it down, and put an upside-down trash can or pot over the top of it so a bird or a kitty or a dog doesn't get it. You can put out poison baits that have to go in plastic receptacles. That's Cornell's recommendation, and October is really the month that's recommended to do that. If they're moles, again, if you have grubs, you can treat for that, but they're usually after earthworms, and you don't want to get rid of your earthworms. So with moles, sometimes you either use a repellent, like a castor oil type thing, or you use traps. Now, the woodchucks, boy, that's a trapping and relocating or having somebody come in professionally trapping them. I don't find repellents work really well with woodchucks. They're persistent.
Fred.
Yeah, I think Bob's got that fairly well covered. I mean, we really want to make sure that if you are going to use those little traps to get voles, and I do think that if he's talking about bulbs and things like that getting eaten in roots, then you are talking more about voles, because most of the time moles, I mean, other than making those little mounds of soil in your yard, I don't personally have much of an issue with moles. In fact, you know, they just become part of the ecosystem, and in sites where I have had to, you know, clients like talk about issues with the lawns and they don't want it there. It's just what Bob had said. You know, you treat the grubs, and there's some great, if you are having that type of product problem, then there's some really good sustainable organic ways to control grubs in a very long-term sort of way. And one of those great ones is just something called milky spore disease. It's a bacteria that you sort of get into the soil, and it'll actually eat those grubs right up. And it mostly treats Japanese beetle grub, which is, I think, number one probably in the lawn that often is getting attacked by moles. But that should, after a few years, it does take a few seasons, that should get you some pretty good, decent control. You know, nothing's foolproof. And then anytime you can get away with, you know, fencing or screening, I've always found that works. And I've also found that using some method of capsicum or like a really spiced up type of pepper flake has had some mixed results and work to keep a number of animals out, but it does take reapplication.
All right, Ryan, so, thank you very much for that
all
one.
Of those.
You know, Bob, you had mentioned putting out, if you have voles, putting out mousetraps, that's one way to do it. It just occurs to me, you know, let's just say you have an average suburban plot, a third of an acre, a half acre, whatever. How many voles are you likely to have? I mean, how many mousetraps would you need?
You know, I've had people say they got 30 or 40 of them.
Yeah.
It's a continuing process because they're like a big mouse. They reproduce the same way a mouse does, so there's a lot of them out there. But generally, they're they're fairly territorial. They will come into one area where the predominant food source is. So you don't necessarily have to place the traps everywhere. Ah. You just keep working at one area.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Gardening today on Vox Pop. Perfect right before the snow. By the way, is there anything that we need to do with our vegetable garden now? It's still, the plants are still there.
You really want to start to clean it up. And, you know, anytime you can put the garden to bed in a really good way in terms of, you know, getting the material out and compost it, clean it out. And, you know, if there's anything that you're going to leave there, there are some things like kale where we still have a fairly sizable kale patch out there, and kale could take a lot of cold temperatures. So we're not even planning to take it all. We're probably going to leave some. We had some come back this year, and that's a good way to sort of treat that if you have kale. But a lot of that stuff, your tomatoes, your squash, your zucchinis, it's really good to just get it out, compost it, clean it up, and then, you know, your garden's going to be that much healthier and more prolific next year, and less disease problems too.
Right.
Tomatoes in particular, if you do have any of that blight and stuff, you really want to get it out, and you may not even want to compost that. And then next year, think about crop rotation. Anytime you can, you know, sort of, if you have that option to plant things in different spots within that garden, yeah, it's always good to mix it up a little bit as well. Just a good, you know, sort of tip as a sort of a cultural thing you do every year.
All right, I'll pass that along to our gardener. Let's go to line two and Rebecca in Amherst. Rebecca, you're on.
Well, I actually have two questions.
Okay.
One is for Fred, and it has to do with the old growth forest discussion. I'm wondering how we in Massachusetts can encourage that when we keep coming up against an administration that's encouraging managed forests where they're selling our trees for cutting. And the other question I have is more in regard to property that I'm about to purchase that's on a busy road. And I'm wondering if there's anything that actually helps acoustically in the way of vegetation. And I was thinking clumping bamboo or potentially some kind of evergreen along the road that would help with the sound of the traffic sound.
Hmm.
Okay, well, I'll start off with that old growth question of yours. And, you know, in terms of, you know, public sites we're talking about, or are you talking about more private sites being protected?
No, I'm talking about public land that the current administration is encouraging cutting, and they call it managing the forests. And I and many other people don't see that as actual helping the forest in any way, but they're cutting.
Right, because I know in Mass you do have some pretty nice old growth. I know part of I've been lucky enough to do some documenting and even climbing in the Mohawk Trail State Forest, where there's some unbelievably awesome old growth being preserved over there, and that might even be in protection status with potentially the old growth network as well. Now, on state land, and if it's not deemed old growth, every state's going to have a little different parameter with that. But here in New York State, I will say that some maybe 15, 16, 17 years ago, I helped co-write a law in New York State to protect old growth forests in New York. And I co-wrote that with a good friend of mine who was passed on now, Bruce Kirshner. And the actual bill is called the Bruce S. Kirshner Heritage Preservation and Protection Act. And that was sort of modeled off of some of the protection laws that they had in place in California, and then we kind of massaged that to make it more fit our northeastern forests. And it was actually passed in New York. It certainly wasn't passed with all the little points that we wanted to include, including the private land protection, but it does protect any old growth forest that's deemed truly old growth on state land. And, you know, you could certainly talk to, you know, more people in this regard, and I'll just give you, because I could spend a lot of time on this, and I know our show is limited, but I will leave you with some resources. And online, if you're a Facebook user, there's two groups, of which I'm a co-founder on these groups. One of them is called Big Tree Seekers, and the other one is called Ancient Forests, and plural. And if you go on to Facebook and you find those groups, hit join, and then in that group, we have probably the largest largest sort of contingent of old growth forest preservationists, ancient forest workers, you name it. And it's international, and there's going to be a lot of people that probably have a lot of input, and including people from Mass that you might be able to connect with, and would encourage you to sort of post that question in the group, and you could say you talked to Fred on the air if you want, and I guarantee you'll get some more contacts, you'll get a lot more info, and you might find out some things that we can do to help try to preserve that, because it's very rare. There's only about 1% left of old-growth forest ecosystems in the Northeast. So, in fact, the entire eastern part of the United States, for that matter.
Now, we only have a minute here, but I know you had a second question, Rebecca. Go ahead.
My second question was about acoustics along a roadway, and if there's any way to do something about that with vegetation as opposed to
fencing. Yeah, sure. You know, the evergreens are going to be better because there's just more density of foliage there, more of the year. And it depends on how much space you have and how much sun you have. You'd be looking at, you know, potentially arborvita, which is the white cedar. Red cedar is juniper, spruce, Norway spruce, or if it's shady, hemlocks. And it depends on how much space you can afford laterally and how much height you want or need. I would think the evergreen would be the better bet. You know, there aren't dozens and dozens of options, but there's a handful of things that would probably work pretty well for
you. All right, we have to take a quick break here. Thanks, Rebecca. Fred Breglia and Bob Graves join us today on Vox Pop. It's gardening. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Bob Graves from Fadigan's Nursery and Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum here today. And gentlemen, a couple of emails here. The lines are we could do this show every day, 4 hours a day, and the lines would be loaded. We'll get to as many calls as we can. This email from Donna in Del Mar. Donna says, I have a fire plug on my front lawn in my suburban single residence neighborhood. Is it legal for me to put a clematis on it? It gets sun most of the day. What's the best way to plant clematis? Can you twine clematis around a wooden porch pole, or is that not advised?
Well, it can go on any kind of structure. I would be very reluctant as a former volunteer firefighter to recommend putting anything on a hydrant. That's just not right. You just don't touch a hydrant.
Okay.
And that hydrant's going to get used or opened or even if there isn't a fire occasionally. So I wouldn't recommend that. Now, you could probably put something close to it as long as it wasn't on it. You know, when you come in and you open one of those hydrants, you put a great big spanner on the top with a pipe and you spin it around, so you can't get anything too close to it. But, yeah, you could put it on. The thing is, most clematis like to be in some shade, and I'm not sure. You know, there's some that would take some sun, but you'd have to be careful what you put out there.
What's the verdict on the wooden porch pole?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you could do that.
Okay. This is from Ed in Albany. Ed says, I have nursed my boxwoods back to health from drought late last summer and leaf miners this spring. When is the best time to spray them with dormant oil? And that's from Ed in Albany.
Well, typically you do that either late this year or early next year. Now, if he's got leaf miners, that's not the best product for it because they're inside the plant. And again, with a dormant oil, you only kill what you hit. But I would recommend doing that, say, like late March or early April next year.
This from Carrie in Montgomery. Hey, guys, 3-year-old peach oozing. Should I get it out of my mini apple peach orchard? And that's from Carrie in Montgomery.
You know, if it's oozing, he's probably got a borer in there. Borers sometimes are not bad, but sometimes borers are real bad. And there are some borers that eat live wood, and there are some that eat dead wood. And the ones that eat dead wood are not usually that bad. Now, that being said, this is not the kind of borer that's eating dead wood. This is actually eating vascular tissue, veins and arteries of trees, xylem, phloem, cambium. So and one borer could take out a peach tree. So if you're seeing that pitch, then, you know, you need to do something to get rid of that borer. And, you know, usually there's sort of a twofold approach. One of them is you actually mechanically try to remove the borer by going in there with a sort of surgical type device. It's more of an almost an engineering issue in terms of figuring out what device is going to fit in there with the least amount of damage. But generally, you know, a combination of sharp sharp knives and pruners, and you know, usually I use some kind of poking device to get in those cavities as well. And then you could certainly take another step and actually treat that with a type of systemic pesticide that's registered for something that you're going to be eating, like a peach, and try to go at it that way. Generally, there's not a lot of them. It's usually like one in there. And if you get it, you usually don't even have to spray. I've controlled a lot of round-headed apple borer on apples when they're young in that stage. They typically get that when they're younger and when they're under stress. If you can prevent the stress, then, you know, keep them watered through those drought times, then they are, and especially when they get a little bit older, then the borer is not as much of a problem.
All right. This is probably, well, it's possibly tied in. This is from Peter in Cooperstown. And our last email, then we'll get back to the phones. Peter writes, do you know why all the wild apple trees are dying off? I've noticed in the last 2 or 3 years, the wild apple trees are appearing dead with branches lacking leaves at apples. Is there a blight in upstate New York that is killing them in our area of Otsego County? This is very prevalent. And that is from Peter in Cooperstown.
Yeah, it's not. It's an apple scab disease. In the last handful of years, we've had some really ideal sort of temperatures for it, weather conditions for it, and it's just making a defoliation, and it's happening in midsummer. And it sort of occurs by the end of summer. A lot of them look bare and dead, but in most cases, all those trees will be all full of leaf next spring.
Fred Breglia is here from Landis Arboretum at Bob Graves from Fadigan's Nursery. It's Vox Pop Gardening Today, 800-348-2551. Jill is in Longmeadow. Jill.
Yes, hi. I'd like to leave the leaves on my lawn for next year. I heard that it acts as really good compost and nutrients. Of course, I'm trying to get away from blowing them or raking them, okay? But I heard that it's actually good for the lawn, and it'll look great in spring 2021. What do you think?
Well, there's a couple thoughts there. If the leaves are really heavy and flat and matted, you know, you can have some harm to the grass if you don't disturb those leaves. You know, some leaves curl up when they dry and get brittle, and some leaves don't. So if the leaves are kind of curly and brittle and not creating a mat on the grass, you can certainly leave them. Now, I've got trees where the leaves tend to produce a mat, and that will tend to suffocate the grass. But then all I do is go through with a lawnmower and chew them up.
Yeah.
And that's I call it composting in place, because basically you're allowing leaf litter is a great source of organic material for the soil. So I never recommend removing it. It's just a question of whether you need to chew it up or not.
Jill, I got to tell you, in my quest to be extremely lazy, Jill, I started doing this a few years ago. I hate raking, and I started this going over it with a lawnmower, and our lawn actually looks better the last couple of years. It actually works.
Yep. It will, and use a recycling mower.
One of those. I'm gonna do that.
Fred,
those mulching mowers work the best.
Okay.
Those ones that have the closed chute, we use that on our own property. It just chews them up really good, and you almost don't even have to. You don't even see anything.
Yep.
So, have one of those, even if you don't have one of those, it'd still work, though.
Yeah, Jill, thanks a lot for the call. It saves so many hours of aggravation. It's wonderful. Diane in Elizaville. Diane, you're on.
Hi. I had a question about beech trees. I have two American beech trees, and I know, or at least I've read, that they, you know, create these clonal thickets. But within like 2 or 3 feet of each of the trunks, there's just, dozens of these knee-high little clones. And I don't know, I mean, it doesn't matter. It's in my woodland corner. But it's not, I just didn't know whether I should cut them, because I know they'll never turn into an actual tree that close to the original tree, but I didn't know whether I should cut them. And then my second question was, what the heck can I do to get rid of ailanthus?
Bob.
Well, with the beeches, they're all definitely root clones. And, if it's in a landscape, or is this more of like a woodland that you have it in? Is it more of
a
woodland?
It's a corner of my property that I'm turning into like a woodland corner. I mean,
okay.
I'm planting ferns, I'm whatever. It doesn't matter looks-wise to me, but I know they won't grow into trees. They're too close.
Yeah, so you might want to selectively remove some. I mean, in a forest, it's going to have natural selection. And, you know, generally, you know, some will just die off. You won't get too many. You will sometimes get a beech thicket in there, though. Sometimes you'll have some fairly good-sized trees that will, before they start to kind of phase out because of competition, they will often, you'll often see quite a few large ones. So if that's not a look that you're after, you could selectively remove them here or there. I would kind of like, okay, you know, use your eye for aesthetics in that case. In a forest, I would say, you know, I generally don't do too much when we see that type of thing occurring in the forest. Generally, not managing them for any kind of woodlot type of way. We're managing them, especially, you know, we see them in old growth forests a lot, and generally we don't do anything with them. So I think you'd be okay either way.
All right, Diane.
But you could aesthetically and run into a spot that, I don't really like that. So you might, you know, in a small piece of property and a little corner that you're trying to create more of a woodsy feel, you might want to selectively use your aesthetics and your eye and take some of those out.
Well, thank you for the call, Diane. We appreciate it. It's Vox Pop Gardening today with Fred Breglia and Bob Graves. We go now to Donna in Albany. Donna.
Hi. I live in a neighborhood where the surrounding lawns, there's kind of a competitive thing going on in this neighborhood. I wonder, just back to the voles and the moles again for a minute, people put these solar, you know, anti-vole things in the lawn, and they make this weird little noise. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if I should get these things and do some defensive, because, you know, I think they migrate to my lawn.
They're chasing them to you, yeah.
Oh, boy.
You know, my experience with electronic controls for animals has never been great because they tend to get used to it. You have things that vibrate. You have things that make noise. You can buy electronic things that have sounds or that are sun-powered. I haven't had wonderful success with that type of thing because they become accustomed to it. Now, that being said, if the other the neighbors have them and they're doing well and they're coming over to your lawn, maybe you do have to do something. I'd be more inclined to trap them because then you know you got them. But, you know,
yeah,
I guess you could experiment.
All right. Well, Donna, thank you. Over to Sean in Shokan. Sean.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about dandelions on leach fields because I've heard mixed things. Basically, I just want to know, is there ever a risk for dandelions that are growing on a leach field to clog up the perforated pipes underneath, particularly on, like, you know, a shallower leach field that's on the shallow end of code?
Gee, I would be surprised that a dandelion would do that. What do you think, Fred?
I've heard the roots are fairly substantial. That's why I asked.
Yeah, they can go down quite a bit. I mean, the record dandelion root, I think, is 4 feet, astronomical. But I also have, all my years of dealing with arboriculture and trees and horticulture, I've never had a complaint from anyone or seen a case where dandelions were the culprit. The one thing I'll say about a dandelion is that it doesn't have a woody root. So something that's herbaceous, and a dandelion generally, you know, its root's not going to stay there for 10 years. It's going to, you know, grow, and then it's going to probably end up, you know, declining sooner. And that, I think, is the biggest factor. I think when you see woody roots, like willow roots and things get in there, those roots don't really die off. They just get bigger and woodier and harder. So I don't think you'd have a major issue with dandelion roots since it's more of an herbaceous plant. And I've never heard that, but like I said, the record there, over 4 feet long for a record.
The fact that you knew that record is amazing.
You had some of those on there, maybe.
How do you even know that? I mean, you have this in your head that the 4 foot.
I tend to have a photographic memory when it comes to horticultural stuff and numbers.
Amazing.
And this one just happened to pick up, I don't know, at some point down the road. I mean, if you want to know the heaviest type of wood, we could have a lot of fun with this. There's a lot of fun with trivia night with Fred.
All right, well, maybe we'll do that on another show. And
what you got to do is harvest those dandelions. They're edible. A lot of people eat them.
There you go.
Yeah, we do actually. You know, and even not to get belabor this dandelion question, but you know,
well,
even the flowers
have,
are edible.
Go ahead.
The flowers are actually really good when you dip them in, like, batter. Like, you can do it egg wash and then dip them in flour and fry them. I've got my youngest boy, Mike, 5 years old. He loves fried dandelions. So, hey, if the kids will eat them, it's got to be good.
Fred, you never cease to amaze me. Let's go to David and Troy before the show's over. David, go ahead. Hello, David.
Hello. So my question is about rose bushes taking over fields. My parents live in Argyle on the farm, and they have these wild roses that just keep taking over. None of the animals will eat them, short of cutting them down, like you said, and stopping the first leaves from producing. What can we do to get rid of them?
What Fred said before, the best thing is to mow them. What I do in my fields is I just brush hog them several times a year. You just have to, if you're not going to use a chemical, and a chemical doesn't work all that well on them anyway because they're pretty persistent things, you just keep mowing and mowing and mowing and mowing.
Yeah, one mowing a year would probably be enough to maintain a field and without woody plants. At the Arboretum, we mow with brush hog. We brush hog our fields at least probably every 2 years, but if we're trying to maintain a field without woodies, it would be done annually, once a year, and we always do it real late in the season after any ground nesting birds would have left.
Real late.
Yeah, real late. Yep, and then you just can brush hog it and do that once a year. You'll also probably see a lot more wildflowers kicking off in there as well.
All right, Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Quickly to Russell in Margaretville. I almost said Margaritaville, but that's a little later on.
That's later on.
2 minutes left of the show. Russell, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I had our local Delaware County Soil Conservation District plant a riparian area. I took some grass out of circulation, and they planted a bunch of trees and woody shrubs and all that to try to widen our riparian boundary. Now, I've got a lot of goldenrod now growing in there, and I would just as soon have unmowed fescues. I'd like to replace goldenrod with fescues. How might I go about getting rid of that goldenrod and then establishing unmowed fescue grasses in there?
About a minute, fellas. Go ahead.
Well, typically if you're going to try to plant something else in a grass type thing, you do what a farmer does. You plow it up. You cultivate it somehow to get rid of that material, and then overseed it with your fine fescues. Your hard fescues are sort of almost like a lawn grass, so it's got to be fairly clean to begin with to get rid of that. They're gonna have a hard time out competing that other stuff. So if you could cultivate it out, plow it up, or rototiller it, or till it would be my recommendation.
Fred,
you might be able to smother it as well.
Be very persistent.
Yeah.
You could smother it with black plastic as well. That would be another option. Smother the area with black plastic. Everything under that black plastic is going to perish in a few months. And then you could do it this fall, and then in the spring, it should be almost ready to go.
All right.
You could get away with just establish, and then the fescue right on that, rake it up, or you're going to have to mix it up a little bit to get that loosened soil on the surface. But then it should just be like seeding, and then grass is pretty competitive. So once it has its spot, it's often better than a lot of other plants, in terms of gathering those needed nutrients. So once it gets established, it's usually pretty hardy.
Gentlemen, that's the program. Fred Breglia, how do we find the Landis Arboretum on the web?
At landisarboretum.org, and also Landis Arboretum is on Facebook. It's facebook.com/LandisArb.
Bob Graves, how do we find Fatigan's Nursery?
Fatigan'sNursery.com. Take you right to our website.
Gentlemen, thanks so much for being here. We'll talk to you soon. Support comes from College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, for over 30 years, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair and 24-hour towing. Full-service gas includes checking of fluids, tire pressure, and window washing. CollegeStreetMotors.com. Nine-Pin Cider Works, Albany, New York Farm Cidery with Outdoor Cafe, open 7 days, offering local hard cider, merchandise, and apparel, also through shipping, ninepincider.com. Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors. Paintings of people and pets from emailed photographs. No contact required. Completed work within 3 weeks. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. And Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear, European styling and prescription and non-prescription sunglasses, eye exams by appointment, EYEDENTITY eyewear, albany.com. That's it for today. Tomorrow, it's the Week in Review with Judy Patrick at 2. Stand by now for the Capital Connection.